Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, July the 12th. We are going to talk about the economics of sex this hour. Not exactly, but I wanted to get your attention, as our guest did with the title of his new book, More Sex is Safer Sex. We'll find out this hour why more casual sex means less disease, like AIDS, and other claims that seem to defy common sense, like a larger population can make everyone richer, a stingy neighbor is often the best kind. Statements that may seem irrational but make perfect sense, according to our guest, and we will welcome your questions and maybe your challenges to these findings at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And please include your first name and your community with your email. Let me welcome our guest. We are very happy to have him with us. Stephen Landsberg is a professor of economics at the University of Rochester. He writes the Everyday Economics column in Slate magazine. He has also written for Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and other publications. He's the author of The Armchair Economist and his very latest, More Sex is Safer Sex, The Unconventional Wisdom of Economics. Good morning.
Good morning.
Unconventional indeed. Are you trying to promote more casual sex?
That's, well, it's a little bit subtler than that.
Tell us about the title, the story behind the title.
Sure. This book is about taking standard principles from economics, principles we teach in the classroom all the time, and applying them in unconventional situations and seeing where they lead us, and in the process learning something about the logic of economics. In this case, the basic principle that we use all the time in the classroom and in economics, is that when people don't feel the costs and benefits of their actions, when their actions spill over onto other people, they often make decisions that are not good for those other people. The classic example is the person who owns a polluting factory and dumps too much sludge in the communal river because he doesn't care about the damage that he's causing to the people who want to swim in that river. That's why the world has too much pollution. By analogy with that, if you are a very promiscuous person who is likely to be infected with terrible things, or a promiscuous or uncautious person who's likely to be infected with terrible things, when you jump into the partner pool by going out and looking for a sexual partner tonight, you pollute that pool. You make it more dangerous for everyone else. You make it a less safe place. And we have too many of those people in the partner pool. It would be good if we could discourage them. So I would like to discourage mm-hmm. casual sex among those people. But the flip side of that, the surprising side of that, is that if you are a very cautious person or a very chaste person or a person who has been monogamous for a long time or for some other reason are very unlikely to be infected with anything, then when you jump into the partner pool, you make it safer. The person who goes home with you is going to have safe sex tonight and might otherwise have gone home with somebody far more dangerous. You're making the world better for other people, and just as the people who make the world worse for other people are doing too much of that, the people who make the world better for other people are doing too little of that. You could actually slow down the AIDS epidemic for the rest of us if you went out and had more sex. Now, am I encouraging you to do that? Not a purely theoretical point. It is remarkable and wonderful. And one of the things that I want to stress in the book is that you can learn a lot from pure logic and pure theory. In this case, also, though we've got data, Michael Kramer is a professor at Harvard, has done detailed epidemiological research on this, and it turns out that if you could take everyone who has fewer than about two partners a year and move them up to about two partners a year, you don't want to move them past that because you don't want to turn them into copies of those very promiscuous people we're trying to discourage. But if you could move people up to about two partners a year, you would slow down the AIDS epidemic. Now, does that mean that I'm encouraging you, if you're one of those safer people, to have more sex? That's a subtle question. I cannot honestly tell you that that would be a good thing for you. If you've decided to be monogamous, if you've decided to have a very small number of partners, if you've decided to be chaste, I assume you're doing that because that's the best thing for you, and I cannot tell you that you're making a mistake. What I can tell you is that the decisions that you make are not necessarily the same as the decisions that the rest of us would want you to make, that that's an important point through all of economics, and that by following the logic of that point wherever it leads us, we can develop some real insight into how the logic works and how economics works and how the world works.
Yeah, but you are giving, though, that chaste person an altruistic reason to break the chastity, aren't you?
If you are altruistic, absolutely. And, of course, people will try and use that line on you in bars all the time,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah, logic tells me, though, that while, let's say I'm that chaste person, while I might slow down as unconventional as it sounds, while I might slow down the AIDS epidemic by choosing to have more casual sex, that's not safer sex for me.
It's not safer sex for you, and in fact, paradoxically, the fact that it's not safe for you makes it even better for the rest of us, because beyond what I've already said, what I said before is that when you take a new partner, you give that partner an opportunity to have safe sex, you rescue that partner from possibly going home with somebody more dangerous. That's only half the story of why the rest of us would like to see you out there. The other half is a little more macabre, but empirically probably more significant, and that is that, as you said, if you go out tonight, you might get infected with something. Well, that's not so good for you, but for the rest of us, that's wonderful. Yeah. Because if you are a mostly chaste person with very few partners, and you get this disease, you're going to go home, and you're going to die with it, and the virus is going to die with you. And that's, from the rest of our point of view, that's great. I would far prefer that the virus go to you than that it go to somebody else who's going to pass it on to 20 other people before dying. I want, if the virus is being passed to people, I want it being passed to people with very few partners, not to people with lots of partners. Again, that's a tremendous conflict between what's good for you and what's good for your neighbors. That conflict is the whole point.
You must have a popular class.
I was just elected Professor of the Year at the University of Rochester, so I take great pride in that.
Well, congratulations. I mean,
thank you.
I normally think of economics as kind of one of those eye-glazing subjects, but you're trying to make it less so.
I am, and I hope this book serves that purpose.
Yeah. Does this mean if my, trying to apply this logic in other areas, does this mean if my skinny husband eats more food, I'll get thinner?
I'm afraid I don't see an argument for that. Although if I saw one, I would love to write a column about it.
Yeah. Well, look into that, will you?
Well, here we go. If your husband eats more food, he'll drive up the price of food, and the rest of us will therefore buy less of it.
All right. Tell us about this other claim that I used in my intro. That how can a larger population be better for us? Common sense tells us that overpopulation strains the world's resources, but you say a larger population can make everyone richer.
Well, when you say that overpopulation or a larger population strains the world's resources, it pays to think a little bit more deeply about where those resources come from. People have this idea that somehow if I weren't here, you know, they look at me, they look at any person, and they say, well, you're consuming food, you're consuming gasoline, you're taking up space, and if you weren't there, there'd be a little more food, a little more gasoline, a little more space for the rest of us. That, in fact, is not true. If I were not here, there would be a little more food and a little more gasoline and a little more land for my sisters, because we all share the same inheritance, but those things would come from other people in my family, not from you. Where we get our resources is in three places. We get some of our resources by creating them. You know, you raise a fish that nobody else was going to raise. That doesn't take from anybody. A second way we get resources is that we trade for them. Well, that doesn't hurt anybody, because voluntary trades make everybody better off. And the third way that we get our resources, in many cases, is that we're given them by our families, or we inherit them from our families, and those resources come not from other people, but from within our family, and our family somehow has made the decision that this is something that they want to do, that they want to divide the inheritance, or they want to divide the parental attention or the gifts a little more broadly when they have more children. Some families choose to have lots of children. Other families choose to have very few children. The families with fewer children, on average, are going to be richer. That's an opportunity to celebrate diversity. You can choose wealth or you can choose lots of grandchildren, and each family gets to make its own decision. But our decisions impinge on each other less than you might think. If I could somehow have 1,000 children, I would be able to do much less for them than I can do for my one daughter. They would each receive 1,000th as much of my attention, 1,000th of much of my gifts, 1,000th of much of my inheritance. They would each have many fewer resources available to them, but that would almost all be coming out of my daughter, not coming out of you and your neighbors.
We are talking about the unconventional wisdom of economics with the author of the new book, More Sex is Safer Sex. And we welcome your questions for our guest professor of economics, Stephen Landsberg. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. We will find out as we go along other unconventional wisdom examples. How can you reduce waiting time by encouraging thirsty people to cut in line at the water fountain, or the bubbler, as we say here in Wisconsin? We'll find out about that after the break. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, Ben's guest says the Internet is destroying our cultural standards and our moral values. That's coming up after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking with Stephen Landsberg. He's a professor of economics at the University of Rochester. He writes the Everyday Economics column in Slate magazine. He's the author of the new book, More Sex is Safer Sex, The Unconventional Wisdom of Economics. And we welcome your questions, your challenges for him. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We do have Roger in Dodgeville, I think, who wants to question the population growth example. Roger, go ahead.
Hi. The resources that we deal with are finite, not infinite, in the earth, in the world. So if you have 999 more children, I don't think they could all survive off the resources that you, your wife, and your daughter are living on. So more resources have to come from someplace. Just as what you trade for comes from a field, comes from a lake, comes from a mine. There's only an X amount, a limited amount in each of those things. So if 1,000 people are drawing from it or 2 people are drawing from it, it will either last longer or be diminished quicker.
I think, you know, if we can think about this in a very stylized way. If you own 100 resources, whatever they are, fish or acres of land or barrels of oil, and I own 100, and I have 1,000 children, and there's not enough to go around among my children, what's going to happen? Those children are going to die off, or they're going to lead terrible lives, or I'm going to foresee that and choose to have fewer children in the first place. None of that has to... Now, there are ways it could impinge on you. If my children decide to form an army and invade your territory and start taking things from you, that absolutely is something you have a legitimate reason to care about. But as long as there are well-defined property rights, there's nothing in my decision to reproduce so heavily that needs to affect you unless you choose to trade with those children because you think it's going to make you better off, but you don't have to trade with them if you don't want to. So again, in the absence of violence, and violence is indeed something that you might legitimately worry about and is an exception to the argument I'm making, but in the absence of violence, you're free to ignore those children if you want. You're free to hang on to the resources you've got and to ignore them. On the other hand, you get a big advantage from their being there whether you trade with them or not, and that is that every time one of those children has an idea, you have the opportunity to copy it. A tremendous amount of our prosperity comes from people copying other people's ideas. Ideas like, hey, I wonder if we can make computer chips out of silicon, or ideas for new methods of crop rotation, new methods of insurance contracts, down to, hey, let's put on a play. The cool point and the economic point here is that when I have a child, my family bears most of the costs of raising that child. My family bears most of the costs of getting that child through life, of endowing that child with resources. Your family, though, shares in the benefits because you get to copy the ideas. You also get to perhaps befriend that child, perhaps fall in love with that child. There are all sorts of advantages that other people get from my children, which I don't get. The general economic principle is that if your actions are helping other people in ways that you don't particularly care about, you're probably doing too little of those actions, which in this case suggests that people are probably having too few children.
Thanks, Roger, for the call. Speaking of hanging on to our own resources, why is the miser or a stingy person, why does that type of person make the best neighbor?
Stingy people are a great blessing to the rest of us because they don't consume resources, and that leaves more resources for the rest of us. The very miserly person who won't eat turkey because it's too much of an extravagance, that means there's one more turkey for someone else to eat. If he lives in a hovel and will not build a magnificent mansion, that means there are more bricks and concrete and mortar for other people to use for things. Now, how exactly do we get our hands on those turkeys or bricks or mortar? The answer is that that person, in his stinginess, bids down prices. By choosing not to buy things, he causes prices to lower a little bit, and that makes those other things more available to the rest of us. If you think about it, what a miser is a person who makes a lot of money and doesn't spend it. That means that's a person who has produced a lot of goods and hasn't consumed goods. That's got to mean there are more goods left over for the rest of us, and it's the kind of behavior we ought to be thankful for.
Oh, but he's not giving any of that money to help out other people or the community either.
But money is not the issue. Money is not what we thrive on. Money is not what we eat. Money is not what keeps us warm. What keeps us warm and keeps us fed is actual food and actual bricks and mortar and other resources. If he's willing to hang on to his money as opposed to trading it for things that can actually feed people and keep people warm, that's a great boon to all of us.
Yeah. What about, though, his contributions to the homeless shelter?
Well, he's not making contributions to the homeless shelter, and maybe it would be better if he did, but let's be clear, if he makes contributions to the homeless shelter, that's not coming out of his hide because he was not going to spend that money on himself anyway. Mm. Whose hide is it coming out of? It's coming out of yours and mine, because as soon as he sends that money to somebody who's going to spend it, be it a homeless shelter or be it anybody else, they're going to start bidding prices up, and you and I are going to be worse off. Now, maybe you and I should be worse off in order to benefit that homeless shelter, but at least the very worst thing is for him to spend it on himself.
Here's one that made me raise my eyebrows a little bit from your book, that I should, if I give charitable contributions to this, that, and the other organization, I'm not doing the good I could be doing. I should be giving all that money to just one organization.
In most cases, you should, and there are important exceptions, which I acknowledge in the book. But for the most part, if you have identified the charity where your first $100 is going to do the most good, and of course there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty about that. You never know for sure where your money's going to do the most good. But if you've taken your best guess for where your first $100 is going to do the most good, whatever reasoning went into that should apply equally well to your second $100. If I have over here on my left 1,000 children dying of rickets and I can save them for $100 each, and over here on my right 100 children dying of scurvy and I can save them for $100 each, there is no particular reason to save one rickets child and one scurvy child. I might, if as long as I believe for any reason that my money is even slightly more effectively spent or might be slightly more effectively spent on the rickets children, say, than the scurvy children, I might as well save two rickets children. Either way, you're saving two children. But if you can identify that charity that's using your money the most effectively, or again, in your very imperfect judgment, is likely to be the one using your money most effectively, that's a reason to give your first dollar to that charity, and it's also a reason to give your second dollar to that charity.
Mm. What if I want to save a child with scurvy, but I also want to, you know, save the abused animal, and I also want to clean up the oceans?
But you see, if you... The very sad and tragic fact is that every child that you save is an abused animal you're not going to save, and every abused animal you save is a child you're not going to save. And, of course, it may not be one for one. It may be one child versus 50 abused mm-hmm. animals, depending on what it costs to save them. But there is some trade-off you're making there, and at some point, and this is the point I want to make, when you give a dollar to the Starving Children Fund, you are making a very tragic choice. You are making the choice that that child... or your dollar can be used more effectively for that child than on the abused animals, and that the good it's going to do for that child is more important to you than the good that you could have done for the abused animals. Important as the abused animals were, the child was more important. If that's true when you're comparing the first child to the first abused animal, it ought usually to be true when you're comparing the second child to the second abused animal. The same logic that leads you to say children are more important than animals, or animals are more important than children, or 50 animals are more important than one child, or one child is more important than 50 animals, whatever logic led you to that when you decided where to give your first dollar, the same logic applies when you're deciding where to give your second dollar. Now, it may not apply if you're Bill Gates, because if you're Bill Gates, you may be able to save all the abused animals or save all the most important abused animals and then move on to another cause. But if you are like most of us, you save an abused animal, that's a wonderful thing to do. I encourage it. It's terrific. You should do it, but you should not fool yourself into believing that you've made a dent in the problem, in the sense that there is another abused animal just as worthy, and if it was worth saving the first one more than it was worth saving the starving child, then it's worth saving the second one more than it's worth saving the starving child.
I want to keep on arguing about this one a little bit, because I still... I'm not sure I get it, but Ron in Wausau has been waiting. I think another resource question. Hi, Ron.
Hello. I was just going to make two comments. One is, I think his definition of resources is somewhat limited, in as much as he's saying that it's what the family has, rather than looking at the broad term of resources. For example, in areas of the world where they're starting to restrict fishing and how intensely areas can be fished, and that's commercial fishing, where if you had a less population, that demand for that particular resource might not be so great. And it's not that I'm giving fish that are caught in the sea by commercial fishers to my children. That is a resource that we all drain on. And second thing is... forgot the second thing I know. But in regards to the resources, I think we're just a little bit too limiting in that regard.
Your caller is absolutely right that my children will bid up certain prices, bid down certain prices, and if I have more children, those prices will be affected differently. However, the thing to keep in mind there is when you drive a price up, you are hurting, when you drive up the price, say, of fish, you are hurting the people who buy fish, you are helping the people who sell fish, and you're doing those things by the same amount. So in terms of the good that you're doing for the rest of the world, any effect that you're having on prices is a wash. It's true that it's helping some people. It's true that it's hurting other people. But when you raise a price by a dollar, the amount that it helps the sellers and the amount that it hurts the buyers are equal. So when we're looking at the effect that your children have on the rest of the world and adding up over all the other people in the rest of the world, that stuff cancels out.
Thanks a lot, Ron, for the call. Do you remember your second thing or not?
Yeah, I do, actually. The whole where his kids, if he raises or has children, he bears the responsibility to bring his children in so it doesn't affect the rest of us necessarily. But there are plenty of examples of people on the public welfare rolls where those children are not being raised and cared for and paid for specifically by the people who are bringing them into the world, but rather the rest of the public is bearing some of that expense.
I agree with you, and insofar as the rest of the public is bearing that expense through those programs, that may be an incentive for people to have too many children, and that certainly is an exception to the logic that I'm offering.
Thanks a lot, Ron, for the call. Back to the charitable giving. I want to contribute to a half a dozen different worthy causes, because, yeah, maybe I'm just giving a little bit of money to each of these six different worthy causes, but I'm helping all of those causes at least a little bit.
You are, but again, what I would like you to imagine is six children suffering from one disease, and six children suffering from another, and six children suffering from another. Why would you choose one of this kind of child, and one of this kind of child, and one of this kind of child, rather than save six of the first kind? Either way, you're doing good. You're doing a certain amount of good. To having saved a child, I now come to the question, I've got a choice between saving a child and, say, an animal, or, again, it may be a child versus 50 animals. When you make your second contribution, why would it be important to make that in an area where you haven't contributed before, as opposed to an area where you have contributed before, but the need remains as great as it was? And that's the whole point. The need in that first charity is as great as it was before, which is not to say you did no good. You did wonderful good, and I absolutely am not denying that. But unfortunately, there are so many starving children lined up behind that you've made no dent in the problem. Why then would you feel that it's more important to go on to a second cause that to continue helping that first cause that you decided in the first place was the most important of the bunch?
Well, I guess so. Wisconsin Public Radio would get all my money then. let's talk about this thing I mentioned a while ago. Why should I cut in line at the water fountain?
Well, I'm not sure you should under the current rules, but the world might be better if we had a rule that said everybody could. Now, the reason for that is that currently at the water fountain, we have long lines, and people get their drinks, but they wait a long time in line to do that. If we had a different rule that said as soon as you arrive, you can go to the front and push everybody else out of the way, what would happen is that people would give up a lot sooner. As soon as there were two people in front of you, you'd realize you're never going to get your drink because new people are going to keep arriving. People would give up, and they wouldn't get their drinks. Now, that sounds bad, but currently there are plenty of people giving up because they come along and they see a line with 12 people in it and not getting their drinks. Either way, the water fountain serves just as many people. Either way, the water fountain can be in constant use, but currently we've got 12 people waiting in line all the time. Under my proposed system, we'd have two or three people waiting in line all the time. Just as many people would get their drinks, but fewer people would waste time standing in line.
We are talking with Stephen Landsberg. He is the author of a book with a provocative title, More Sex is Safer Sex, The Unconventional Wisdom of Economics. Stephen Landsberg is a professor of economics at the University of Rochester. He writes the Everyday Economics column in Slate magazine and has also written for many other publications and author of another well-known book, The Armchair Economist. We welcome your questions for him about these unconventional wisdoms. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I think when we come back from the break, we'll talk a little bit about his ideas on how we can fix our democracy. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. A recent report gives Wisconsin a B- in health, but a D for health disparities between whites and minorities. After 9, John will talk with a guest about why this is. That's coming up in our next hour. We're talking with Stephen Landsberg, who is a professor of economics and who has written a book, More Sex is Safer Sex, The Unconventional Wisdom of Economics. The More Sex is Safer Sex title comes from using logic and economic theories to remind us again, Stephen Landsberg, that is, if more people go out and have sex, casual sex, that reduces the number of people who have sexually transmitted diseases and therefore could reduce the AIDS epidemic?
Well, it's not a matter of any random people going out and having more sex. It's a matter of getting the people who are particularly likely to be uninfected to go out and have more sex, and the kind of people who are particularly unlikely to pass infections on to go out and have more sex. That those two things would slow down the epidemic.
So, and remind us again what this has to do with economics.
It illustrates exactly the same. In fact, the argument for why it would be good for these people to have more sex is exactly the same as the argument for why the world has too much pollution. If you think it's obvious that the world has too much pollution, you haven't looked at things subtly enough. A lot of pollution is worth having because it's a necessary byproduct of things that we want to have. Most of us would like there to be at least some cars in the world, for example, and cars mean pollution. So some pollution is something we're willing to live with. Therefore, just the fact that pollution's bad does not prove we have too much of it. In order to see that we have too much of it, you've got to look more subtly. And the argument there is that there are some polluting factories, polluting firms, that weigh the costs and benefits of having that factory. And when they weigh those costs and benefits, they do not account for the costs that they're imposing on their neighbors. And so when they look at benefits versus costs and say, is this factory worth having here, they're not counting all the costs, and that's why they're making bad decisions from a social point of view. That's exactly the same argument that's going on here in reverse, because we're talking about benefits, not costs. When people decide to stay chaste, when they decide to stay monogamous, they are weighing benefits and costs. They're saying, what would be the benefit to me of having another partner? What would be the cost to me? And they're making a decision. And in doing that, they are not accounting for the benefits that they would confer on their neighbors if they did have more sex by making the partner pool a safer place.
When people
don't account for all the costs and benefits they're conferring on their neighbors, they sometimes make wrong decisions. And this same argument that we need to convince ourselves that there's too much pollution, that same argument tells you that there is too little casual sex by a certain kind of people.
We'll get to your suggestions on how to fix our democracy in a moment. We have some callers who want to ask about some of the past examples. Marty in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Joyce. I've got a question about the example of the water fountain, and I'm really concerned that it doesn't point up a flaw in the whole approach that your guest is bringing forward. Yes, if you have a long line in the water at the water cooler, that's presumably less desirable than having short lines. But what about considering the fact that you're going to have bloody battles at the front of that line as people get cut in?
Absolutely, and I acknowledge in the book that may be the killer argument against this particular proposal at the water fountain. On the other hand, a variant of it might be exactly the right way to organize telephone lines for tech support, where the first caller goes to the front of the line and you've got a recording telling you there are six people in front of you now, you might as well give up. For a given amount of tech support, you'll still have the same number of people being served, but because people are giving up sooner, it's actually a better outcome.
But don't you risk a kind of a collapse of the system if I'm online waiting for my call to be answered and I'm not told that I'm sixth in line but I'm still waiting half an hour? Won't I not only give up but I'll abandon that service provider because the service is so bad?
We're going to have to do a lot of education in terms of making people understand how the system works. And absolutely, it will not work unless you're getting constant updates on where you stand in line.
It seems to me you're abstracting too much for one item and you're leaving out other issues that may be as valuable to the individual involved and to the whole society, aren't you?
Well, let me suggest gently that you might want to buy a copy of the book where I claim that I understand. I have absolutely addressed all of the issues that you've raised here in the book,
okay.
And I'm sorry that I can't do it in a brief time on the radio. But I do want to absolutely, You're thinking exactly right. The issues that you're raising are exactly the second round of issues that you want to raise with these things. You're right on track, and I
Marty gets an A.
Absolutely. You're asking all the right questions, and I think if you buy the book, you'll find at least some answers.
Thanks, Marty. Aaron in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I finished a bachelor's degree years ago in economics. Though I work in a different field now, a couple of concepts have really stuck with me, and they kind of haunt me to this day, and I take every opportunity to sort of tell other people about it, but I don't always have the vocabulary. These two concepts are imperfect information and real costs, that what we pay at the cash register does not always include everything that went into making that product. And I'm just wondering if the guest has any really good sort of anecdotal stories to help, you know, get those concepts across to people. Because people don't always get the concept of economics. They think it's about money. And really it is about, it's about stuff. It's about goods and utility.
Well, I think that all the examples that we've talked about today are in many ways illustrative both of imperfect information and the concept of real costs. If we go back yet again to the sex example, imperfect information is key here. If we all knew each other's HIV status, there would be no problem with people choosing their partners wisely. The fact that we have imperfect information about each other's HIV status is precisely why we want more relatively chaste people out there in the pool to keep us safer. These ideas of, you know, imperfect information leading to bad outcomes, that absolutely underlies almost everything we've talked about today.
Yeah. Thank you, Aaron. Mary in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I think that the guest is forgetting about a whole other dimension to life, and that is happiness. There's the pleasure part of it is contained in what he's been saying, but that's not what's real in life. And
Are you referring just to the sex example, Mary?
No, to everything. The using lots of, or that wealth is good.
Yeah. I think, you know, wealth clearly is good. It's clearly not the only good. Wealth contributes enormously to our happiness. The fact that we're not all dying at age 35, as we would have been a couple hundred years ago, is entirely a result of our wealth. The fact that our children make it past infancy predictably is a result of our wealth. The fact, more recently, that we have effective painkillers, that we have ibuprofen, that's a result of our wealth. The fact that we have the internet, the fact that we're talking to each other over the radio right now, this all comes from wealth. There is no question that wealth is an enormous contributor to human happiness. It is absolutely not the only contributor to human happiness. And one of the messages that in this book is that we need to worry about things other than wealth, that we need to worry about other things that make us happy. And if you buy the book, I think you'll find lots and lots of examples in there of applying economic analysis to all of the things, or at least to many of the things that go into human happiness. But wealth is without doubt a very big part of all that.
Let's go to Mike in Green Bay. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Hey, this is very interesting. I'm going to go pick up your book. My question is, how do you figure in efficiency? Everything you're saying is like a one-for-one exchange. How would you figure in more efficient fact? You know, if somebody's more efficient at producing something or we become more efficient. How do you figure that in?
I'm not sure exactly what you want me to try and figure it into for you right here. But of course, the concept that things should be done by the people who do them most efficiently is an absolute bedrock concept of economics. There are several examples in the book that we haven't talked about today where I've made that sort of the highlight centerpiece of the argument.
You want to pull one out? Or?
Sure. Take outsourcing. Take outsourcing of radiology, for example. We have it's now technologically possible for X-rays to be sent over the internet to doctors in other countries who can analyze them and send back their analyses far more cheaply than doctors in the United States can. That's a tremendous boon for us in terms of healthcare costs. The fact that these other doctors who can do this more efficiently, therefore can do it cheaply, therefore can do it more cheaply than our homegrown doctors can, is, as I said in the book, it's as if we had discovered a machine that's cheap to run and that reads our X-rays for us. It makes us richer. It frees up American resources to go into other forms of healthcare. And I do talk in the book about how much we've benefited from that.
All right, let's talk about some of these ways we could fix our democracy using your unconventional wisdom. Fix Congress by letting everyone vote twice, once in their own district and once in a district of their choice. How would that help?
Well, it's, again, an application of the same concept, which is that we want people feeling the costs and benefits of their actions. Right now, when the senior senator from West Virginia spends your money in his state, his constituents get to reward him for that with their votes, but you don't get to punish him for it, and therefore he does too much of it because he feels the benefits, but he doesn't feel the costs. My proposal is that you should get to vote twice in each election. You get to vote once in your own district, once in the district of your choice, and if a congressman in another district is spending too much of your money, you get a chance to let them know how you feel about that.
So you can cast a vote against somebody you don't like somewhere else in the country.
Yeah.
Pay the president with a portfolio, a diversified portfolio of real estate. How come?
In order to give him an incentive to make the entire country a better place to live. One of the best measures of whether the president is doing a good job is whether people want to live in the United States. And one of the best measures of whether people want to live in the United States is land prices in the United States. So if you tie the president's compensation to land prices, essentially you're giving him pay for performance. You don't want to give him a whole bunch of land in one place, or he'll favor that place. So you give him a shopping center in New Jersey and some seaside property in California and a dairy farm in Wisconsin. But you make it diversified enough, and he's got no incentive to favor any particular region, but he's got a powerful incentive to do a good job.
Here's one that you might run into some arguments over. Fix the justice system by fining juries if they exonerate a guilty person and they find an innocent person guilty.
There are subtleties to this, which I'm afraid we're not going to have time to get into, but I'll be happy to give you the basics of it, which is that every now and then we have a trial where we find out afterward, essentially for certain, that the jury got the verdict wrong. And my idea is that in those cases, the jury should be punished. Or sometimes we find out after the fact that the jury absolutely got the verdict right via evidence that was not available at the time of the trial. Let's reward those juries. Let's give them a reward for a job well done, a fine for a job poorly done. The main point that I want to make in the book is that this would be incredibly unfair to jurors, but the fact that it's unfair does not make it a bad idea, because jurors, sometimes many jurors do very good jobs just out of a sense of responsibility, but sometimes they fall asleep during the trial. Sometimes they don't pay close attention to the arguments. Sometimes they let themselves be cowed in the jury room. And when they do that, there is a tremendous unfairness to the defendants. There's a tremendous unfairness to society. Innocent people go to jail. Guilty people get put out on the street and commit other crimes. There's a fantastic amount of unfairness there. If we can give jurors an incentive to do a better job, we will reduce that unfairness at the cost of being unfair to a lot of jurors, because sometimes we'll punish them for mistakes that are no fault of their own and that they could not have helped. But what I want to highlight is that this is not a question of whether we're going to be fair or unfair. It's a question of how much fairness of one kind we're willing to trade off in order to have more fairness of another kind. And the decision we've made in almost every other walk of life is that people get rewarded for jobs well done and they get punished for jobs poorly done, even when it's not their fault. You can start a new radio show and you can do everything right and everything wonderful. If the listeners don't come for some random reason, you don't get paid. There's some unfairness in that, but we accept it because we believe that on balance it means we're going to get better radio programs. Likewise with the jurors.
Because it's all my producer's fault. No. What about this one? Encourage better informed voters by eliminating tax withholding and making all taxes due on April 15th. How's that going to encourage better informed voters?
Well, you're going to know exactly how much you're paying in taxes. Tax withholding sort of allows it to disappear from your paycheck in dribs and drabs, and it sort of never hits home how much in total you're paying. So I would like to see people pay all their taxes on April 15th just to make them a little bit more aware of what government is costing them and a little bit more thoughtful about whether they're getting their money's worth.
We're going to be, that big bill will make us think twice. And then finally, we talked a little bit about this before. Is this related to the miserly neighbor? Create more philanthropy by encouraging more people to act like Scrooge.
Yeah, exactly. What we want to do is we want to encourage people to save, because when people save, they're not spending. And when they're not spending, that means that there are more goods available for other people. When people are not spending, prices are lower. When prices are lower, people who otherwise might not have been able to afford a turkey for Thanksgiving can afford one. And so in many ways, the best, if Scrooge wants to put turkeys on other people's tables, the best way for him to do that is simply to save his money, and then prices come down and other people get more turkeys. We want to encourage saving, and there's a lot that we can do in terms of the tax system to improve that.
Yeah. One of the co-authors of the book Freakonomics, which has been discussed on this and other Wisconsin Public Radio programs, had great praise for your book. But the reason I bring this up is that my producer did put a note on the board saying, our assignment board saying, this is Freakonomics Part 2. It is not, is it?
The way I like to draw the distinction, I'm a great fan of Freakonomics. I wrote a rave review of it in the Wall Street Journal, and I think I had a lot to do with its popularity, actually. I'm a great fan of it, but this is not the same book. Freakonomics, the way I like to explain it, Freakonomics is out to dazzle you with facts. I'm out to dazzle you with logic, and I think Freakonomics does a wonderful, dazzling job with the facts, and I hope I'm doing an equally dazzling job with the logic.
Well, you've got me thinking, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stephen Landsberg is the author of More Sex is Safer Sex, The Unconventional Wisdom of Economics. Stephen Landsberg is a professor of economics at the University of Rochester. He writes the Everyday Economics column in Slate magazine. He has written for Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, other publications, a past book, The Armchair Economist, and this book, More Sex is Safer Sex, The Unconventional Wisdom of Economics. And we thank him for being with us. We thank Carmen Jackson for producing the hour, and we thank Karen Prager for on-air production. And we thank you for listening and for calling in. If you would like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, you can call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444, 1-800-747-7444. You can also listen to our talk shows. They are archived on our website, wpr.org, wpr.org. I hope you will join us tomorrow during this hour. It's our regular Friday Week in Review when we talk with two guests from different perspectives about the news of the week. And we always enjoy hearing from you during our Friday Week in Review. Every Friday between 8 and 9. I'm trying to remember who we have on tomorrow. I think we have Paul Soglin on. And who else? Who else do we have on, Karen? She's not listening to me. Anyway, we'll have another great guest with Paul Soglin tomorrow. Thanks for being here, and I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.